An interview here in my office at the Florida Museum with Dr. Willard Stone, and this is March the 30th, and we are doing this in connection with the oral history project relating to the Fisher School of Accounting. And I'm going to start off, Willard, if I may, by asking you your name, your full name, and your date of birth.
Well, my full name is Willard Everard Stone, and I was born in Germantown, Pennsylvania, on August 28th, 1910.
Give me that middle name again, if you will spell it.
E-V-E-R-A-R-D.
Is that a family name?
No, I think my mother got it from a French novel.
The Willard, you say, is a family name?
It has an extra I and goes back to the 1820s when William Stone married Abigail Willard.
This, and just be absolutely... Well, let's go all the way back then to that early marriage. Where did your family come from, the Stone family?
Well, the male, Theodore Willard Stone, came from Gloucester, New Jersey, and was English.
So the origin then were the British Isles for the family.
I've not been able to trace it back to the British Isles, but I know that he was English. My mother was Irish and Scotch. Her father was Scotch, her mother was Irish.
What was her name?
Blanche Patton.
Two T's,
P-A-T-O-N.
P-A-T, one T?
One T.
Where was she from?
She was from Philadelphia, born in Philadelphia. And my father was born in Philadelphia.
What was your father's name?
Theodore Willard Stone, Jr.
What business was your father in?
He was a contractor and builder, carpenter, contractor and builder in Philadelphia.
Do you know anything about the progenitors of your mother, the Patton family?
Very little, actually. I don't know when they came to the United States, but she was born in here in the States, but I've not been able to trace back that branch of the family.
Are you an only child?
Yep. Spoiled.
So you were born in 1910 in yes. Philadelphia, a yep. Germantown. Mm-hmm. Which is, what is its relationship to Philadelphia?
It's a suburb of Philadelphia.
Was this a comfortable family?
Yes.
Middle class?
My grandfather, definitely middle class, and grandfather was reasonably wealthy for the time. My father never became very wealthy at all. But we were a middle-class, comfortable family.
Tell me a little bit about your early childhood. Where'd you go to school?
Well, I went to school in Germantown, of course. And we moved when I was 8 years old to Olney, Philadelphia, which is North Philadelphia.
How's that spelled?
O-L-N-E-Y. And there... I went to school through the eighth grade. Then I went to Frankfort High School in Philadelphia for 2 years. And then I went for 3 years to Westtown Boarding School then, a friend's school out near Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Why there? Why a boarding school?
Ah, that was because I wanted that. I liked the idea of a boarding school. My cousin was there, and it was a wonderful school.
Were you a good student, Willard, growing up?
Yes, I was always a pretty good student.
What were your interests?
Student-wise?
Academic interests.
Well, history. I thought back then mathematics, but I found out that I didn't have a really first-class mathematical mind, so I dropped out of that in college. I did go through as a math major to my degree, but I never did anything further with it. And I read a lot. I was a very avid reader.
Did you live in a family where there were lots of books and that kind of activity was encouraged?
Yes, mother and father both read some. I don't think they were great readers. I read through the library. We had a local library there in Philadelphia. I started at one end and read through the library. I just go in and take out an armload of books every about twice a week, and I read it very avidly for a while.
What about sports?
Well, never amounted to too much in sports, although I swam at Westtown School, and through a very peculiar circumstance, I have a record that's never been broken in the Westtown pool. I swam the dash and broke the school record in a meet with Girard College. And shortly after that, they ripped the pool apart and put in a bigger pool. And so they've never had I don't remember the number of feet, but it was a very small pool. So no one ever had the chance to break the record. It's still hanging in Westtown's school.
Your claim to fame.
My claim. And when my children went there, my three children, three boys, all went to Westtown. And they were very impressed, finally.
Tell me about growing up.
Well, I was
in a one-child family.
Yeah, I was a gangly kid. Not very athletic. Not very good at athletics. Not good at teamwork. And I suppose as I read so much, I was really a loner somewhat.
Was this a religious family?
Well, yes, several. My mother was basically first a Methodist. My father was first a Presbyterian or an Episcopalian. I'm not sure which one of those. And I broke off. I didn't like either one of them and became a Quaker by myself. My mother and father did not. Basically, I think I became a Quaker so I could go to Westtown. But I was a Quaker for quite a large number of years till we came to Florida here. And then finally, 10 years ago or so, I became a Unitarian.
Now, what kind of a school was this Westtown?
It was a boarding school for boys and girls. It had been started about 1790-something. It was a very early friend school, the first of the friend schools in the Philadelphia area. And they were rather strict when I went there. They had no piano, and people were not allowed to whistle.
They were not allowed to whistle.
No, one boy was suspended for whistling on the sidewalk out of Westtown just before I'd gotten there.
Did you say this was a Quaker school?
Yes, Quaker school.
And they had this forbidding of music?
Well, they just didn't appreciate it.
Oh, all right.
But they did get a piano while I was there. One of the first piano came.
I hope they allowed some whistling before you left.
No, I couldn't whistle. So it didn't bother me.
But it was good instruction?
It was a school that they build great loyalties. Their alumni are very, very loyal. I went from there to college, Penn State, and I never had a great deal of loyalty for Penn State, but I did have loyalty for Westtown, and sent our children and grandchildren now are going there.
Do you get back for reunions?
Oh, not as often as I should, possibly. It's a little bit of a trip up there. But I've been to many reunions. Mm-hmm.
Now, you elected to go to Pennsylvania State University with a major in mathematics. Why?
Maths and English Lit.
Why that school?
Because it was cheaper than... we had no money in the family at that time. It was during the Depression, 1929. And
you started in 29 and received a degree in...
33. And we had no money at all.
Had the family lost money? Had it the stock market crashed?
Well, my grandmother left me $3,000 to go to college, which would have covered. But my father wouldn't let me take it to Penn State College, because of a small bank. That bank never did fail, but he put it in the big bank, Bankers Trust in Philadelphia, and it failed. So I got 1 year out of the 3,000, and the rest went. Mm-hmm. So from then on, I worked my way through college. My family was not able to help me. I borrowed some money from the Knights Templar, Masonic Order. But mostly I worked, I had five different jobs.
Doing what?
Well, I announced on the radio station. I was an assistant to an education professor. I modeled for nude classes.
That must have been an interesting...
I was treasurer of the fraternity, which paid part of my board and lodging. And finally, I refereed soccer games, because Westtown is a great soccer school, and I had played soccer there. I refereed soccer games around State College, center of Pennsylvania.
Now, what fraternity were you in?
Well, it started out as the Friends Union, and the fraternity decided they didn't like that name, so they changed it to Sigma Phi Alpha, which was a small national fraternity. And a good old Quaker from Cheltenham, where I lived at that time, was furious, and he used to say, Sigma Phi Alpha, signify nothing.
You said you were living in Sheltendown?
Cheltenham.
How do you spell that?
Cheltenham.
Now, what kind of a student were you in your undergraduate?
I usually was on the honor list at Westtown. And I made some of the honor societies. I missed... Phi Beta Kappa, because I didn't have enough. I was in the School of Education, unfortunately, and I didn't have the proper courses. But I had the grades to make it.
So you say you were both a mathematics and an English major and your undergraduate.
An undergraduate, yeah.
What kind of literature did you like then?
Well, I read pretty much the library. I mean, I read novels, of course, but I liked biographies, history books. I became an amateur archaeologist and read a lot of that.
Of course, if you were going to school and you were also working at all of these several jobs, you were a pretty busy man.
I guess I didn't read so much at college.
Were you a social animal?
Well, I was courting my wife there at Penn State, and I was a fraternity member and went to dances and on a toot once in a while.
So you met Louise?
At Penn State.
What was her name?
Louise Harder. Louise Cousins Harder.
How's that Harder spelled?
H-A-R-D-E-R.
And is she a Pennsylvania?
No, she was from Buffalo.
How did she end up in at Pennsylvania State?
Her father had gone there in 1903, mm-hmm. graduated from there in 1903, so she went back there. Most of her family went to Cornell, but she thought there'd be too many boys at Cornell. She went to Penn State and found that she was 1 out of 10.
What was her major?
Home ec.
And did she eventually become a teacher?
No. She quit school at sophomore, at the end of her sophomore year because of financial difficulties, and we were married a couple of years later.
So when were you married?
1934.
Now, you graduated then in 1933, mm-hmm. and did you then immediately go on to... You didn't immediately go on to college.
No, not for her.
All right, what did you do once you graduated? This is still the Depression decade.
At first, I worked in the American stores where I had worked summers and some after school as a clerk. And finally, I worked my way up to assistant manager.
Is this a clothing store or...?
American Stores was like A&P.
It was grocery.
Competitor of grocery.
American
and
Stores?
Meat, and meat, yeah.
So it was groceries then?
Yeah.
Not supermarkets such as what we have today?
No, it was a little local store. Mm-hmm. And I worked there through college every summer. And when I finished... I went to work there again at graduation in 1933. There were no jobs. And I went to the vice president of the American Stores in Philadelphia and told him I needed a job and my experience. And he gave me a job in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania, right next door to Cheltenham. But the supervisor and the manager did not like to lose their power over the job, and so I lasted until I took an examination to work for the Liquor Control Board of Pennsylvania, and they fired me for missing a day's work. But fortunately, I came out 14th out of 1,400 people who took the exam, and got a job right away in 1934.
Doing what?
I was an accountant for the Liquor Control Board of Pennsylvania.
Now, your math background enabled you to take on a job as an accountant?
The reason I got the job was because the test they made, I never had any accounting work. No schooling of accounting, none. But I took the exam, and it turned out to be what's the term for your measuring your brain capacity? What is that term? It was a simple, normal exam, which didn't have any accounting in it.
So you were able to...
I had been, as an education major in college, I had given the exam many, many times, so I don't know why I ended up 14th instead of first.
What did you do in that job as an accountant?
Well, I was an accounting clerk to begin with, and I very quickly got in charge of the IBM punch card system, which was in operation then. I ran that system for them for 4 or 5 years, I guess. Let's see, I eventually went with the United States government as a cost accountant in 1945. So I was with the Liquor Control Board from 34 to 45.
What were you doing during the war years?
I worked for the Controller General, GAO.
Where?
As the principal accounting auditor in Philadelphia.
You say as the principal accounting lawyer?
Accounting, principal accounting, principal accountant was the title.
Because you had no law background.
No. I had no law, no connection with the law.
You were not called into service, or were you too old, or the fact you were married?
Oh, I was 1A and 2A, 3A. I had one child by that time, and I would be 1A for a while, and then I'd be put back into 3A. But I never did get called in.
What did you do as a, did you say GAO?
Yeah.
What did that stand for?
General Accounting Office, which is the office of the Controller General of the United States.
And you worked in Philadelphia in that capacity?
Yes.
And what kind of work did you do? Describe your work.
Well, we were auditing government contracts. And I made the first overhead audit that was ever made in the GAO, which resulted in a claim for about $250,000 against the Kellett Auto Gyro Company, but they never filed it.
Now, this means that thousands of military operations and otherwise...
Never audited military operations, although the GAO did and does, but I audited only government contractors.
I see.
Subcontractors.
And these then were... all over the United States.
Mostly mine were all located in Philadelphia.
These were contracts let by government agencies,
yes.
And then it was your job and the people that worked with you to make sure that they complied with
That's
rules
right.
and regulations.
We had to audit every single document that they made claim.
Mm-hmm.
We audited every claim. It was a very sterile kind of audit, actually, but...
Was this a good-paying position?
At that time, I doubled my salary when I got the job. It was I was making something around $4,000.
And that was good money at that time?
That was pretty good. Very happy with it.
When were you and Louise married?
1934, May 19th.
And you say you have 3 children?
Yes.
Give me their names and birth dates.
Theodore Willard Stone III. Birthday is February 21st, 1938. Donald Edwin Stone. His birthday was January 9th. I can correct these later on.
That's right, absolutely.
I'm going to have them all wrong.
Well, no problem.
He was born about January 9th in 1950. No, 1945, I think. And the third one was Richard Patton Stone, P-A-T-O-N. Who was born August 27th, 1950.
Now, all of your boys are married?
No.
But you do have grandchildren.
I have several grandchildren and some great-grandchildren. Ted is married. His daughter, youngest daughter, is graduating from Westtown this year. His oldest daughter, who is coming to visit next week, lives in Long Island, and is a runs a pet store. And his son is at the University of Buffalo. And there are no grandchildren, no great-grandchildren from that group yet. Don's family consists of Greg, G-R-E-G-G, Stone, I can't remember the birthdays of grandchildren.
Louise will remember.
Oh, I have them written down. He is married and has two children. The second son, Stephen, is at Cornell in his doctoral program. He's just finished his prelims, his orals. And he's going to Brazil for his PhD dissertation. He's being married this year. They have a daughter, Serena, who is married to a black, Ade Robertson. And they have a wonderful child. And he has a Don has a latecomer, Serena, who is 10 years old now. Katara, K-I-T-A-R-A. And she's 10. Birthday, December 29th. 10 years ago, whatever that is.
You said that Theodore was the third.
Theodore the third, yeah.
Who's he named for?
Well,
he's not named for you.
We skipped my father. My father was Theodore Willard Stone Jr., mm-hmm. and his father was Theodore Willard Stone.
And so you jumped you, and he got a third then.
Yeah.
Well, that's one wonderful way to carry on the family tradition, of course. So you worked then until 1945 for the federal government. You're based in Washington.
No, I was based in Philadelphia.
In Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you said that. You were based in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Now, why the change in 45, and what was the change too?
Well, they did away with the classification, war service indefinite. And in 45, they just closed it down.
Did that leave you then without employment, or were they transferring you? Or?
No, they just let us go.
I thought civil service even then was protecting you.
No, we were war service indefinite. And when that job was closed out, everybody lost their job. Mm-hmm.
Of course, times had changed considerably by the middle 40s in terms of employment.
Yeah.
So what did you do? You now have two children.
Yeah, I had built up, while I was working for the government, I had built up a small accounting practice. I'd gotten my CPA, and I went into a partnership with Vincent L. Fisher in Philadelphia, and we ran the partnership for 2 years. Pretty tough going against the big firms. He eventually became controller of Sharp and Dohme, and I went to the Wharton School and started to teach as an assistant professor. I taught there for 14 years.
Where, give me your degree history now. You are at, you go to the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania for your MA degree?
No, I went to the University of Pennsylvania for the MA, and yes, I guess that was Wharton, finance and economics.
You get that in 1950, I think your record shows.
I think so.
Yeah.
And then I took the PhD with a major, University of Pennsylvania Wharton didn't have a PhD at that time. I took it in, I couldn't take it in accounting, I had to take it in economics and finance.
And I noticed management and economics.
Our economics and management, and finance was my master's degree.
And you took the PhD in 1957. Mm-hmm. Were you teaching in between?
All the time.
All the time. Mm-hmm. So that's why it took you as long as it did to get the PhD.
Well, of course, the 10 years was lost in the Depression. From 33.
No, I'm saying from 1950 to 1957, you received the MA in 50.
Part-time.
Yeah. The private firm activity lasted 2 years. When did you get the teaching, the job that you had after you lost your position in Philadelphia in 1945? You told me you went into a private a partnership.
Mm-hmm.
That would take you from 1945 to approximately 1947.
Mm-hmm.
And is that when you then went to the university?
Well, first I went to Drexel, taught in the night school at Drexel for 1 year, and then was offered the position at Wharton. And so I took that. My partner took over the Drexel night school. But I became assistant professor in 1947.
How did it happen that you would be offered a position like that with just a bachelor's degree?
It was a miracle, honestly. I happened to be there at the right time when Dean Thomas Budd needed somebody to teach, and I turned out to be quite a good teacher. So I never had any problem after I got in.
But were they part of the explosion, student explosion, brought on by the GI Bill after the war?
Yeah, there was.
What did you teach?
Well, I taught beginning accounting. I lectured to 900 students in the evening school. That was the first job that I took with shaking knees. And then I taught in the day school also. I taught taxation, I taught auditing, I taught intermediate accounting, I taught in the graduate degree, Wharton's graduate school, I taught the Paytonian accounting. And auditing and controllership.
I noticed you received your CPA in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
Also, everything in the state of Pennsylvania, of course.
Yes, yes.
Now, did you stay an assistant professor throughout your career at Wharton, or did
Almost.
You move up?
I moved up to associate professor. I'm not sure of the year. Is it in there? It must be there.
No, it does not. Let's see. Yes, the assistant associate professor, and you were at Wharton from 1947 to 1960. The Drexel is not listed here in your.
No, I didn't. I didn't put that in.
Yeah, you talk there at night.
Yeah.
And was Wharton already the big prestigious school? It had the big reputation as it has now.
Wharton had a pretty good reputation, yes.
It was attracting students from all over the United States.
It had coasted for quite a few years, though. At one time, every important business textbook was written at Wharton, you know. But by the time I got in, it had fallen off a bit, I'm afraid.
How large of a faculty did it have?
I have to guess.
Were you one among many?
Wharton, well, in the accounting department, about 10.
What about the students? How large was Wharton and taking accounting?
I'd have to guess again. I'd say maybe 200.
And you started out in the night school?
Actually,
and then...
actually the undergraduate degree, that's the 200, eventually became smaller than the Wharton graduate. Their graduate school gained in reputation, and their undergraduate lost a bit.
Did you perhaps get the advancement, receive the advancement from assistant to associate at the time that you received the PhD in 57?
I think so. Well, no, it should be there. It should be.
Well, it shows that you just covers the 13-year period that you were at Wharton.
Mm-hmm. Assistant and associate.
All right, then we
it's
now
about
come...
about 57 now.
All right, how did it happen that you came to the University of Florida?
I heard that there was an opening here for a department head, and I came down, and I was very much impressed with the climate, the school, the area, the Dean Hart, the faculty members. I liked all of them, and... I came home and told my wife that's where we're going. I'd had a long, hard row at Wharton. They were very slow to promote issues. So I came down here as a full professor, which was good.
Was that an increase in salary?
Not much. I think I was making $10,000 at Wharton. And I got 12.5 when I came to.
Now you say you heard about the position at the University of Florida?
I don't have any idea how.
But you applied for
applied,
it then?
I applied, yeah.
They didn't come seeking you?
No, I applied.
And in those years you would have applied directly to the Dean, Donald Hart?
Yes.
And he invited you then to come down?
To come and visit, yeah.
And you like what you saw?
Very much.
You like Gainesville?
Yep.
It was a big change from the big city of Philadelphia, though, wasn't it?
Uh-huh, and a change to the good. I particularly disliked Philadelphia for two reasons. One was ice and snow, which were terrible in the winter. And the second was wind, which was always dirty, and I always had something in my eye in Philadelphia. I missed it so much when I got here to Gainesville. Really wonderful.
So you arrive in Gainesville, you like what you saw, they obviously liked you, and they made you a job offers.
Yes.
As chairman of the Department of Accounting?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was there already an established Department of mm-hmm. Accounting here?
Yeah.
Who were you replacing?
That name escapes me for the minute.
Well, you will think of it.
But he was a department chairman. I will.
Was he retiring?
No, he was. He went to another job.
Was this Anderson?
Hmm?
This was not Moby Dick Anderson.
No. Dick was never chairman. Kind of. Oh. I'll think of it.
Well, we'll get to it. I just wondered what the circumstances were which created the vacancy, which you obviously
then filled.
I
don't know what was back of his leaving, but I think it was a little bit unpleasant. I don't know.
Describe the accounting program when you arrived at the University of Florida in 1960.
It was a good, solid accounting program with a graduate degree, even up to the PhD, and these things were very important to me, and we had a good faculty, and was well thought of, the school, did very well in CPA exams, the students did.
And were they able to be placed in good firms?
And we had, our only problem was satisfying the local firms that we weren't sending all our students to the national firms. We had a lot of trouble over
that.
Did
the college already have an MBA program in place when you arrived?
Yes.
And you say it was strong also in its graduate program?
Yes, it had both an MBA and an MA.
Who were some of the faculty people in your department when you arrived?
Well, Harvey Deininger was one of the senior professors. Larry Benninger was one of the senior professors. Carl Anderson was an assistant professor. There were several. Keith Austin was an instructor. There were several instructors.
Was it a strong department?
It was pretty good, except that it had too many instructors, part-time instructors, mm-hmm. which I fired them all, or was able to replace them all within a couple of years.
You wanted a full-time faculty?
Yes, with degrees, and we got them.
You were in Matherly Hall. That was your office then?
Yes.
Were you satisfied with the situation?
Very. We had a joint secretary's office with the real estate department under Al Ring, and we shared a secretary. No, we did not. We had separate secretaries, but we shared the secretary space between the two offices. I was very satisfied with the job. I liked Dean Hart. I spent the greatest part of my effort in faculty recruitment for the entire time I was there. And I think rather successfully. We had all PhD people and as professors at the end. And
what were some of your... What were some of your students who really became prestigious in terms of their careers?
Fisher.
Fred Fisher.
Yeah.
Fred made a lot of money.
Yeah. That's good. The senior managing partner for Haskins and Sells was one of our students, but I can't think of his name at the moment. He's quite well known, of course.
Where did you and Louise live when you first arrived in Gainesville with three children?
Well, we didn't bring any of the children with us. Ted was at work, was at the University of Pennsylvania Engineering College. Don was at Lehigh University. And Rick, our youngest one, was at Westown. So we came without children. We lived first on First Street in a rental apartment with a lot of green mold on all of our shoes and clothing, no air conditioning. And then we bought a house at Clear Lake Drive at the end of University Avenue in Northwest Gainesville. And we stayed there for quite a few years.
Gainesville was a relatively small town in those years, wasn't it?
Yes, I'm trying to think of the population at that time, but I can't. It's 1960, it was a small town.
Mm-hmm.
Took me 5 minutes to get to work.
That was not an unhappy thing at all.
After Penn, when I had an hour of hurrying, driving down Schuylkill Driveway, Schuylkill Driveway, they called it.
How did Louise adjust to Gainesville?
Just fine. She liked it from the minute we arrived, and she was active in the various women's organizations in the university.
So she was not unhappy to leave the big city either?
Not a bit. She was a little bit unhappy about leaving the children, but they were all of an age you could leave them.
Discuss a little bit the college under Don Hart when he first arrived.
Don was a wonderful dean. He
succeeded Matherly.
Yes, he did. And he did an excellent job as dean, and he was a believer in strong department heads. He gave a lot of power, a lot of responsibility, rather, to the department heads. And I think he had good ones. We built a school up under Dean Hart and under the department heads. And now I'm just a wonderful person to work for.
Where is he now?
Don is dead. He died at North Mountain, Black Mountain, North Carolina. He went from here as president of a small denominational college in North Carolina. I should remember. I'll fill it in later. Then he went to North University of North Carolina for a few years, and he died rather suddenly about 2 years ago.
So we won't be able to get him on tape,
no,
I don't think.
Don, you won't get
we waited a little bit too long. Now, you were both the chairman of the department and professor of accounting.
Yes.
So that meant you were in the classroom also.
Yes, I taught the basic accounting course for all people. It was a 500 size lecture. And I taught auditing. I taught taught intermediate at times. I taught a graduate course in history of accounting, which was my hobby. I most of my work was done with the basic course.
Under your supervision, under your direction during the 1960s, how would you compare the School of Accounting, let's say, with other schools, or the Department of Accounting, with other departments at other Southern universities?
I think it was very near the top. Our nearest competitor was the University of North Carolina. And they made me an offer, by the way, to come there. But I think we were certainly, the accounting department has always been, I think, about the tops in the Southeast. The last rating that I heard of nationwide was at the University of Florida Accounting School was number 10 in the nation. And
that's the Department of Accounting.
Well, that was the School of Accounting.
Yeah.
That became the school.
But you didn't call it a school
not
yet.
Then.
Yeah.
No.
So the Department of Accounting during the 1960s stacks up very well. It's a strong department here, and it compares.
End of tape A, side one. The interview continues with tape A, side two.
Well,
or is that a difficult question to answer?
It depends on. In 1974, it was ranked number one in the United States by the partners of the CPA firms, the national firms. And other departments, other county departments ranked it number 5 or 6. So it had a pretty good reputation.
Willard, how do you evaluate the strength of a department like accounting? What is it based on? What are the criteria?
The rankings are always opinions of other professionals, other professors, universities, and they take all of the big universities and send out questionnaires. So they're opinions, but they look at the number of PhDs, the teaching load that they carry. They also look at the positions carried by the faculty members, president of the American Accounting Association and so on, which John Simmons was. And they look at the number of articles that are published from the school. I never made president of one of the big firms or big accounting associations, but I was vice president of the American Accounting Association, and I was editor for the Journal of Accounting History for the Academy of Accounting Historians. And several of our people were well known in their fields. Larry Benninger was a good writer, cost accounting.
Well, and I want to go back for just a moment because there was one thing that we left out here in talking about your business employment, and that was the job that you had as assistant to the president with the Raleigh Manufacturing
Raleigh.
Company. What was that?
Well, that was a war industry, and as a partner in the firm, the president of that company came to us with his income tax return. And we got his return straightened out for him. He had some problems with a partnership and so on that he'd been in before. But he invited me out to Raleigh as a consultant because they were failing. And by dumb luck, I guess, or grace of God, I was able to point out where their problem lay. They hired me then as assistant to the president, and I was there for about 2 or 3 years.
What kind of work did that company do?
They were a foundry, a magnesium foundry, and they did the basis for the Nike Zeus, which is the largest piece of magnesium ever cast. And they were deeply into war work and had loans from the government. And as assistant to the president, I actually acted as treasurer, too, up until for about 2 years, and then they hired another treasurer. And then I left of my own volition to go back to teaching, back to Wharton. I was teaching at Wharton all that time, too.
I noticed that during the time that you're here in the 1960s, that you also were doing a good bit of consulting with various organizations and firms. The State Farm Insurance Company, for instance. What would you have done with that?
Simply a coach course that I gave over in Jacksonville.
I see.
For their CPCU examination.
And you did it then successively for 10 years.
Yeah.
From 60 to 1970.
That was an evening course, and I drove over to Jacksonville to give it.
And how about this educational consultant with the United States Comptroller General?
Well, that was for several years there.
1963 to 1968.
Mm-hmm. We were called into Washington on occasion to help design their program, the GAO's program, and their educational program in particular. They had several, about five of the prominent professors from Illinois and Washington.
What about these Stanford. These two editorial positions? You mentioned those earlier.
Yeah.
Discuss those a little bit. One I noticed with Holt Reinhart and Winston.
That was
a book series.
Yes. I first went with Chilton Company in Philadelphia, and took them a couple of accounting books. I was their accounting editor. And we had about five books, which were bought out by Holt Reinhart and Winston, and they bought me with it. Now, this was always a part-time job. I did some traveling for them, and I picked up books, and I edited books for them, counting books. It was a very pleasant association.
And what about this next position as an editor with business administration editor? Oh, this is the Chilton Book Company of Philadelphia.
Yeah.
From 57 to 61. And then you go with Holt Reinhart.
Reinhart and Winston.
From there. So that you really had a lot of experience then as a book editor from 13, 14 years.
Yes.
And I noticed you were also book review editor for the Management Services magazine for a period of time during that period. Well, you list yourself 1967 to 1975.
Where is that?
Magazine Services, Management Services Magazine, American Institute of CPAs. Under your consulting experience.
Yeah. Don't know how hard they remember that. They have a number of book review editors which simply edited articles that came in. So that was not a very, I had no real editor position there.
I'm presuming all of these were pay jobs.
Oh.
You were not doing it just for the honor.
That management service was the honor. Later editorship of the Academy of Accounting Historians was not paid. They don't pay even the biggest one, the Accounting Review magazine, is not a paid, I don't think. It may be now, maybe.
Well, and I'm curious about this association that you have with the Jacksonville Sheriff Department. That seems a little bit out of...
yeah. Let's see. I've forgotten exactly how I came to that, but I mean, I don't remember who recommended me, but somebody recommended me to Dale
Carson.
They were changing from, that's when they merged the county and the city, and they were merging the police department with the sheriff's department.
That was a period of consolidation in Duval County.
And they were having some problems with their management setup, how to get that straightened out. And I had to see how long was I there.
Well, according to this, you were there for almost about 3 years, 69 to 71.
Yeah. I had a once-a-month meeting with the department heads, which Dale always attended, and all the department heads.
So you drove over to Jacksonville monthly?
Yes. and just helped them set up their management system. I didn't have much to do with their personnel, you know, but I did, in a sense, train all of their management people. Their management people all came to this one evening a month, 3-hour meeting. Mm-hmm.
And you trained them in accounting practices?
No, management. No
management? No. Nothing to do with accounting then?
No. That was pure management.
By management, what do you mean? Explain that.
Well, it was the traditional management approach of setup of an organization, the organizational form. We went through strategies and that the police department should have and how to implement them was, I should be able to rattle off these things. It's been a few years though. But, you know, strategies and then you have policies, principles and then policies, and we went through all those. So it was an organizational lecture that I gave, and they had a book that they read, and we talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very rewarding experience.
And a successful experience?
I thought so. They made me an honorary detective when I left. I told them I was so proud of that badge that I was going to put it on my windshield when I went to Jacksonville.
Did that help you with speeding tickets, you think, or parking tickets?
I never had one.
So you were all right.
Mm-hmm.
How long were you here at the university?
Here? I came in 1960 and left in 1980. I retired in 1980, but came back and taught till 1982.
Now let's talk about the thinking, the philosophy behind setting up a separate school of accounting rather than continuing as a department.
Well, to the accounting profession, this was a number one objective. They wanted an accounting school, the equivalent to a law school, separate from other domination in the university.
They wanted a separate budget situation?
Yes, separate budget, separate hiring, power of hiring, which we had.
Was this something that was just based upon ego, or was there a real need for this kind of thing?
A very large number of the accounting profession believed that this was a very necessary thing for their profession, to have the prestige that the law school gave the lawyers, and they were very, very keen about it.
Sounds like an ego trip kind of thing.
Well, they were running into some problems with some of the universities not permitting them to teach what they wanted to teach. Not enough courses, not enough accounting courses. Later on, we found that we had too many accounting courses, and we broadened the curriculum. About the time the school began, the curriculum was beginning to be broadened considerably. But they were very honest people and very devoted to the school, their schools. They put up a tremendous sum of money, you know, when they formed the school here. They put up $1 million to begin.
Did most of the CPAs in Florida, were they graduates of the University of Florida? Were they Gators?
Florida State has had a almost equal department.
As early as this?
Yes.
The 60s?
When I came here, they had an outstanding department.
So the two state universities then was feeding the supply of CPAs in
That's
the state?
Right. Yes.
Were you competing with FSU?
Well, we were always very friendly. We had meetings together for the Institute of Certified Public Accountants. We would have a meeting here one year and over at Florida State another year. We were very friendly with the faculty. I don't think we competed, of course. Every time we went to go to hire a new PhD, we competed with Florida State.
Did you already have in the 60s a board of advisors, a committee the campus?
No.
That comes about with the creation of the school?
That came about with John Simmons. Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, a number of departments and colleges on campus have boards of advisors made up of people off the campus. So how did you relate to the CPAs in Florida?
Well, we were very close with Clifford Beasley, who was the secretary for the Florida Institute.
They had their offices here, did they not?
In Gainesville, right down the street.
And what was their, what role did they play?
Well, dog in the manger. I better strike that. There was not too much love lost between the national firms and the local firms. They saw that the national firms snuck in and got the best students, and they were relegated to the C students, really.
When you say they, are you talking about smaller firms in Florida?
In Florida, yeah. And they had a monopoly. They would not, in order for a national firm to come into Florida, they had to meet all of the Florida department's regulations and get a license. And they would only give them a license for one job at a time. They had to apply for a new license every time they got a new client.
There were national firms like Arthur Anderson already in Florida.
Oh, yes, but only on that basis, on a license basis.
Were they then milking your best students?
Well, they got the best students, there's no doubt about it. They got the A and B students.
So the association that Cliff Beasley administered, this was organized by the smaller firms in Florida to protect themselves.
Yes, it was a protection agency.
What did Beasley do, and who was Beasley?
He was a very strong secretary, and he had the backing, complete backing of the local firms in Florida. And he was a very powerful man in Florida.
Is he still living?
Yes, he is. I just saw him in the paper the other day. Some burglar got in, and Clifford and Francis were, I think, robbed, burgled.
What's happened to the offices? They're no longer on University Avenue. The foundation has that property.
No, I honestly don't know where they are now. Doug Thompson became the secretary after Cliff Beasley. And I don't remember where he went.
Beasley is a graduate of the University of Florida?
I think so.
But it still is a functioning operation organization today.
Yes.
And is it still doing the same job, trying to protect the smaller firms?
Undoubtedly, I have no doubt. Doug Thompson broadened it quite a bit. But they were very strong with the Florida legislature. Clifford Beasley was a very good contact man with the legislature.
By the 1970s, you had big firms in Florida, the growth of the state.
Always on the license, though.
Is that still true in 1993?
No. I honestly don't know the full history of this. They finally, one of the firms, Arthur Anderson, I believe, took them to court and broke the monopoly. So that they are now part of the
So the push to do a, to create a separate school on this campus, a school of accounting, came about as a result of outside pressure, the desire on the part of small accounting firms in Florida, not necessarily small, I guess.
No, particularly it was the national firms who pushed it. The small ones were all in favor of it, and strongly in favor, but they didn't put the money out.
Was this part of a national trend? Was this happening
elsewhere?
It
was a national seeking for the school. Now, I'm not quite sure that we're the first school. John Simmons probably told you about that. But we were very close to the first. There was one at Rutgers before us, I believe, but he probably gave you that history.
How enthusiastic were you and your faculty in this effort to create a school, particularly since the pressure is coming from outside the university?
We were all in favor of it, but...
You were in favor of it?
Oh, yes. All of the faculty were.
From a prestige point of view?
I think so. It was helpful that way. But it really got started almost from the beginning by John Simmons when he came in 74.
Had there been, there must have been some planning and thinking before Simmons arrived.
Not very much.
Committee had been set up to begin to evaluate?
We discussed it, but Lancelotti was very much against it.
Mm-hmm.
He would hear nothing about it at all until they came up with $1 million. Then he changed his mind. And he became dean, you know, of the school to begin with.
So he's aboard as dean before the school is created?
Oh, he was the dean of the business college, yeah.
Before you have a school?
Yes.
What do you think Lancelotti's objections to it were?
He wasn't going to give away the accounting department from under his control.
In other words, this was the plan that the accounting would move out of the College of Business and have its own separate operation.
That was what they wanted, yes.
With a director of the school,
right,
who would be comparable perhaps to
a dean. Or a director comparable to Lancelotti.
Mm-hmm.
And the sword that cut the Gordian knot was making the dean of the school. That's when they got it.
That overcame Lancelotti's resistance to it.
Yes.
So Lancelotti, however, might have seen the value of a school in terms of attracting support and money.
Yep.
But from a personal point of view, he was not enthusiastic about it.
I don't think so.
And what about Willard Stone?
Well, I guess I was short-sighted. I never saw it as a possibility. I never worked toward it. I worked towards good relationship with the accounting firms, and we got lots of support from them and so on, but... I must have been partly blind. I knew about the school, but I just didn't consider it a possibility for here.
You knew, though, that this movement was underway elsewhere in the United States?
Yes, I did.
Did you think then it was good or bad?
Well, both. Certainly prestige-wise, it's good. But it has the danger of becoming too specialized in accounting courses.
Mm-hmm.
In the accounting school. Now, I think they've broadened a great deal since they first started. And even the CPA requirements set up by the State Board of Accountancy require a broad education now rather than a narrow. They used to tell you what courses you had to take when I was here.
I want to get into that, and then I want to get back to the schools. But since you brought up broaden the base, it's often suggested that many of the people, the graduates who come out of the professional schools on this campus and elsewhere, engineering, accounting, medicine, really are not humanists. They're almost over-specialized in their areas. Now, when the University College was first created here in the 1930s, one of the major objectives of Dr. Taggart was that students in their first 2 years would be given this liberal education, which they could then take into the specialized colleges. Mm-hmm. Now, when you arrived on campus, just that was still here.
Yes, well, it didn't really.
You approved of general education?
I was sorry to see it go.
It didn't leave until the end of the 1970s.
Yes.
But there was resistance from the College of Business to it.
Not from me. And I don't think the accounting department ever had any active part in doing away with... I always understood that it was the liberal arts...
well, that was in part of it.
...departments and... who were against that idea.
Well, there was a lot of resistance to it very early on. Now, Dean Matherly was an early supporter of general education. Mm-hmm. In fact, Dean Matherly was the first dean of the general college before it became a university college. Mm-hmm. But Weil and others in other areas of the campus, even in the 30s, strongly resisted it. I don't know how Don Hart felt about it when he took over.
I'm pretty sure he was in favor of it.
And I suspect that Matherly's influence and impact on the college in those more formative years probably developed this liberalizing philosophy. But you saw the value of it.
Oh, I was very definitely in favor of it, always.
Hasn't the school, though, moved away from that? When you left, for instance, in the 1980s, was there still the demand that your students have some feeling for literature and history and the humanities?
I think there was, yes. I don't think it was terribly apparent. And I can't remember the requirements of the degree, but I'd be surprised if it wasn't quite liberal.
Well, the CPA firms in the state that were beginning to push for the school, which comes into existence, they want the students, do they not, to have many accounting courses? And
Yes. They're not particularly concerned about the liberal arts courses.
They don't really care whether the graduates knows who's Shelley and Byron.
No, but they're very interested that they have enough accounting courses, which for an accountant is pretty many. They still have quite a few accounting courses.
Were you here when they began to move the curriculum? Did they not expand it to a 5-year period, or did
yes.
was it?
The 5-year period came about largely through the Florida Institute of Certified Public Accountants putting in a requirement that in order to sit for the exam, you had to have 5 years.
5 years of what?
Of college.
No, but I mean 5 years of what kind of college courses?
Well, accounting major was an accounting MA or MBA. I think it's an MA, isn't it? For the last year. That came about just about that time.
But Willard Stone, the humanist, the man who had read from childhood on,
yeah.
and obviously loved literature
yep.
because it's part of your background.
Yeah. And history.
And history. You considered yourself to be a humanist.
Yes.
And you pushed this kind of a curriculum?
I'm afraid I rather accepted the curriculum that we had a fair amount of humanist courses, particularly when I had the two-year beginning. But even when that was out, it still had a good number of beginning courses. Now, when you got into the junior and senior year, it was mostly professional courses, mostly, largely accounting. But I pretty much went along with the curriculum that we had. I was satisfied, well satisfied with it.
Willard, as you reflect back on those earlier years now, the 60s and the 70s is what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. How do you judge your colleagues in the college in terms of this question that we're discussing now? The Clem Donovans and people like that, Alfred Ring, Butterworth, the department chairs.
They were strong department heads and strongly in favor of their own department and mostly concerned with it.
Protecting their turf.
Protecting their department. I'm sure they all agreed that we needed a certain amount of liberal arts, and I think that probably a little more than we had. We all agreed to that.
At least they gave lip service to it.
Oh, yes, at least that. But I think their major concern was with their courses, the business courses.
Now, let's get back to the formation of the School of Accounting. I understand from what you're saying here now that in the 60s there was no planning committee and that the pressure came from outside of the university and outside of the college.
I don't know what you mean by pressure from the outside.
Well, encouragement, perhaps.
Well, even, yeah, I guess even your pressure. The Florida Institute actually listed the accounting courses that every student must have.
I see.
To become, to sit for the examination. And they had one course in there which we didn't like. It was governmental accounting, but it stayed for a couple of years. It took me 2 years to get it out.
But all of these things could have been met within a department of accounting. You did not need a school in order to develop this kind of a curriculum.
No, I don't think we did.
So once again, I gather from what we're saying here that the school comes about as part of a national movement in an effort to develop prestige, status, stature, and all of those things.
I feel that. The school, of course, is a 5-year program, which was actually started before the school, again from outside pressure, when the legislature passed the law that in order to sit for the exam you had to have a 5th year of accounting. But I honestly, I'm intending to agree with you that the major thing of the school is prestige.
And it was an expensive thing, too, because to have a separate dean and a separate secretary and a separate all of those other wonderful things.
But we got the money from the outside and...
to start it up.
Yep. I don't think our faculty are... Well, I think on balance the faculty is pretty much the same as it was... When I first came, it was a good faculty with emphasis on graduate work, but good teaching and undergraduate and attention to the undergraduate work as it existed from outside pressure. the fact that all of the courses were named, and was, I think, a bad thing.
Willard, why didn't you become the first director?
Why didn't I? I had no... well, I was at the end of my rope, I guess. I was 75.
Well, this comes about now in the 1970s.
Well, I was 70, and yeah, this is about the 70s. I was born 1910, so I was...
So you were in the 60s, yeah.
60s, yeah.
Now, at that time, you remember that an administrator had to retire at the age of 65.
Yeah.
And a faculty person at 70.
Yeah.
So were you then so close to the 65 that it would not have made sense for them to have appointed you as director?
Well, I could only have been there for 1 year. And they preferred to take a new man, Simmons.
Were you disappointed that they did not make an effort to hold you?
No, I was not. I had accepted retirement. You know, the idea of retirement.
Although you stay on now for another 15 years, or 10 years,
no,
until
15.
The 1980s.
It was 74 when they
started
that.
Okay.
So it was, I stayed on until 1980.
Yeah.
So 6 years. Yeah.
Now, the people that were from the outside, the consultants or the advisors, people like Al Warrington and so on, were you in part responsible for selecting them? In other words, were you involved in the planning for the school is really the question I'm asking.
Not really. I don't think I was. We had not had the idea accepted. At that time, I had nothing really to do with it.
So you're the chairman of the Department of Accounting,
right.
And you're here,
right.
And they're planning a school of accounting over there. I'm trying to see where the bridge is. I'm talking now about the 70s.
I think the bridge came right at the point of my retirement. And I don't think they waited particularly for me to retire, but I didn't have the vision.
But you don't retire until the 80s.
That's right.
As a member of the faculty. You
right.
mean retiring as the chairman of the Department of mm-hmm. Accounting.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
In other words, they're saying now Willard Stone is getting ready to retire.
That's right.
He's approaching the age of 65. Therefore, now we can move ahead to the school. I don't mean to say it was
I must admit I was not enthusiastic about the idea
of the school.
Of the school for the University of Florida.
Why?
I just didn't think of it. I knew that the dean was upset against it. We talked about it, but he had no intention of having any such thing.
But you saw the kind of thing that they were talking about,
yeah.
The ego business, stature, all of those kinds of things. And you had come out of Wharton School, which, of course, was perhaps the prestige school in the United States at that time.
At that time, yes.
So you come out of a background where there is, in effect, an independent operation.
I was very friendly with all the accountants. I never had any problems with professionals. I had some problems with the institute, trying to balance the professionals and the locals, but never any major problems. They were always friendly.
But so you had an amicable relationship then with these. Many of these were your former students.
Yeah. Oh, yes. A good many of them. And I don't think that I had the vision for the school mm-hmm. here. That was largely due to John Simmons and Al Warrington and several others.
in a way, it's kind of interesting to note that they were able to bring this school into fulfillment, notwithstanding the opposition of Lancelotti, and really sort of the kind of non-enthusiasm on the part of the accounting faculty. Am I saying that right? Not opposed to it.
That's exactly right. They were not opposed to it. I was never opposed to it.
But they didn't get out and pick up they didn't get out and pick up the weapons to fight for
it. But they didn't go to fight for it. No, you're right. You're right.
So that's why I say it's kind of interesting that this kind of an operation, which has become a major thing now on this campus, would come into existence. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that suggest that there's a lot of power in these firms off the campus that they're able to bring this about?
No doubt. I haven't any doubt about that. Well, I think it was the power of the major firms that did it.
Of course, the fact that they were able to come up with $1 million.
And several chairs, so on.
And they must have gotten some support from the Board of Regents. You couldn't have done this without Tallahassee support.
Yes. They probably worked at that angle, too, although I know nothing about it.
And maybe even some legislative pressure.
I would assume, yes.
How about Taggart Hall? Where were they in all of this? See, this is a transition period. O'Connell is leaving. Yep. You've got York in there as an interim president.
Yep.
And Marston coming in.
Mm-hmm. Brian was the real power
because they controlled the curriculum and also the purse strings in that office.
Yep. And I just never discussed it with Brian. I did not push it. I'm sorry. I wish I had.
Did any of them come to you and say, Willard, what do you think about this? Did Brian come to you? Did Hemp come to you? Did Marston come to you? Mm-hmm. Any of these people and say, "This we're getting this kind of pressure from the outside. You've been at this university now since 1960. You're chairman of accounting. What do you think about it?"
I was never asked. I'd have no regrets about it.
Do you think any of your faculty was asked? To your knowledge?
Well, I think if they asked the faculty, they certainly would have asked me.
Yes.
They would have started. I don't remember ever officially of course we discussed it.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't remember ever having been asked an official opinion on it. And I doubt very much whether, until the thing was pretty far along, the faculty were asked.
You know, I was just wondering, did y'all think it was such a far-fetched thing that would never happen that you figured, well, let them talk about this, and it's not going to happen anyway. Why waste our time?
As I said, I lacked the vision.
But you were not alone in lacking the vision, because obviously your faculty...
But it took a spirit. John came in and spearheaded it.
But John would never have come in if the decision had not been made to do this. And I'm really a little bit before that of trying to figure out where the determination came to go ahead with the establishment of a school.
I can't answer you. I was not part of it.
And the dean was not part of it.
I would say he knew about it, but I didn't think he was enthusiastic.
Well, I'm going to find out because I'm going to interview him next week, and I'm going to ask him the same questions I'm asking you.
You may get the right answer then.
I may not. He may say the same thing that you are, that they did this not with me, but because of me in many ways. Yeah. Although, obviously, you were not putting up any impediments or obstacles in their way.
Not number one, even. I would hate this to come out. that I was against it.
No, I understand exactly what you're saying, that you were
lukewarm
not.
Lukewarm when it was finally...
But if it happened, it happened.
I just have to admit that I didn't have the vision for it.
Willard, let me ask you about the fundraising, not necessarily for the School of Accounting, but fundraising in general for the college. To what degree were you involved in that in the 60s as chairman of a very viable department?
Well, I started the idea of funds from outside, and we had a bank account down at the First Savings and Loan. And we solicited funds for particular items. Now, if we came up with a particular thing that we wanted, I could usually get the money from local firms or from the national firms. And they did put in a good bit of money. It was peanuts compared to what it was later, but... they would give me $250 for some new books, or when we hired a new tax man and he wanted $1,000 for additional tax services, we raised that very quickly among the local firms and the national firms.
You could call them up and say, this is what I want.
But I had to have an object for the money and ask for it for a specific purpose.
Willard, did you consider yourself to be a fundraiser? Were you comfortable in that?
I was comfortable in it, but I did really very little and very minor.
Actually, the foundation was in its very formative stages then.
Yes, it was. Yep.
It gets organized under O'Connell, but it really has to wait until Marston is aboard for it to become a big-time operation it is now. But even early on, they were beginning to solicit for scholarships and support for students and so on. Did you do much of that beyond just the raising relatively small sums on the local level?
I must admit I did not. I'm sure that some chairs came in, but...
No, chairs didn't come in until, I think, a little bit later.
They didn't. That's what I'm trying to remember. I don't remember chairs having had anything to do with any of the chairs.
No, chairs come in at the in the late 70s. You're moving off the scene then. That kind of legislation with matching and all of that, Marston is really the man who initiated much of that kind of thing.
I had nothing to do.
So if there was fundraising, it was in the earliest stages of it. But I wondered, how about Don Hart? Was this something that, as you remember...
Don was not particularly a good fundraiser. That's why he had trouble as president of his college. He was unable to raise the money to keep the college going. And... he left under somewhat of a cloud for
guessing. Were you...
connected with money.
Did you have to... were you called upon to go to Tallahassee, to the legislature, to promoting for the college?
Never. No. No, I never... I don't think I've ever visited the legislature, even as a visitor.
Well, what role did you play on the campus, beyond just your department, committees, activities?
Well, I had a fairly substantial role. I was, you may remember, the graduate council, dean. I got along very well with...
Grinter?
End of tape A, side two. The interview continues with tape B, side one.
See, when I came for an interview, I interviewed Dean Grinter, and Dean Grinter was not terribly impressed. He said he thought I was too weak a man for the job.
He told you that?
He later changed his mind, thank goodness, and was one of my strong supporters. We did a bit of publishing in the department. I encouraged the faculty to write, and I wrote considerably myself. And Dean was always backed us up on that. And Dean Gerner was a very strong friend.
All right. Well, you get along fine with the dean of the
press
college.
Was another relationship that I had. I tentatively ran it, I guess, for a while. You remember when it was in disgrace and they were going to close it down.
When Bill Haynes was leaving.
I went and offered to take over the directorship of it.
But you had no publishing experience?
Well, editorships is not really.
You went
and
to...
And Bill's trouble wasn't with the publishing. Bill's trouble was with money.
Yeah.
And I took over the control of the money for a couple of years.
Who did you offer your services to?
Dr. Bryan. Dr. Bryan was my connection with the university.
And he probably received you with enthusiastic arms.
Well.
Knowing the press at that time.
At least they didn't close the press down, which
That's
was touch
right.
and go at the moment.
They were looking for some kind of steadying influence there.
Bill was very appreciative.
Bill and Helen Haynes, yes.
Yep. And then I became a close friend of the new director. Was a poker player, and we played poker together, very friendly.
And he came to a tragic sad end.
He had cancer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, what committees were you active on within the college?
I was on the budget committee a good bit of the time.
That was a powerful committee, obviously,
yes.
because
yes.
you had to determine how the pie was to be sliced up.
And where the drippings went.
You were on the Graduate Council?
I was on the Graduate Council.
And you worked with the University of Florida Press?
Yes.
In a very active role there. You were not in... You were not on the press board, though, were you?
I got up to president, but a very short time.
Yeah. Were you involved in the library? The library committee?
No.
Curriculum committee?
No. I did not have other connections that I know that I can remember.
How did you relate to students, Willard? Was your door open, and did you have the kind of personality, as you reflect on it, that students came in and talked to you about their problems?
I always directed the graduate program and had a very close relationship with the graduate students. We had parties at our home and so on. I had a good relationship with the students.
As you felt that students like you, you weren't an SOB.
No.
You were a person that they felt they could turn to.
Yeah, they came to me with complaints on occasion. I met the undergraduate students in this large lecture that I gave on Accounting 201. I still get people to come up to me and say, "Oh, I remember you, Dr. Stone, from my basic accounting course." I think I had a good relationship.
How about with your faculty?
I had good relationship with them. They were a bit weird, some of them, a couple of them.
Well, they're in the College of Business.
No, they're professors.
Oh, is that it?
And there was a continuing dissatisfaction with the fact that I could not pinpoint how the number of dollars went. Now, I tried my best to do that. We used to have a rating for the department faculty based upon their teaching, their publication,
their service,
the various aspects of their work, you know, mm-hmm. and we rated them each year. By and large, they accepted the rating fairly reasonably, with not too much complaint. One student, one professor in particular, didn't like my ratings. But I think, a good relationship with the faculty.
A good social relationship,
yes,
also?
Yes, we had a strong social relationship, always. My wife is very good at that.
Mm-hmm.
She still goes to lunch with the old accounting faculty members.
When you look back on it, Willard, do you think it was wise for the School of Accounting to emerge?
I think it was a great step forward.
And you think that it was wise to have the kind of arrangement that they finally worked out, a cooperative arrangement rather than the one that they wanted
you
to?
You mean the
single
council?
Dean, yeah. And the single dean.
I think
dean.
It was extremely well done, yeah. Yeah, I'm in favor of everything that's been done.
Because they were doing it, you remember, on an experimental basis for 6 years.
Yeah.
And at the end of the 6 years, the decision was made to have the single dean and to really have the school part of the overall College of Business.
Yeah, which it was all for those all 6 years. It stayed the same, mm-hmm. really. But I think
I mean, you're looking at it now in 1993 over events that occurred 15 years ago, mm-hmm. and you're not part of it now.
No.
But as you think about it, you think it was all good?
Yep. Nothing is all good.
No, but I mean, you don't think the university made a major mistake
in
doing this at all?
No, not in any respect. They still have the respect of other schools for their graduate program, which could be a problem. The professional and graduate are not exactly... Mm-hmm. in step.
Right.
And they've held both. They were recently rated in a poll by Illinois, University of Illinois, as number 8 in both the graduate and the undergraduate, the school and the graduate program. Number 8 in the nation.
Which is very excellent.
Wow, that's pretty tops. Pretty good. They were 10 back when I was here. They went up as far as 8.
I notice in looking over the material that you sent me that during your years when you were here and even earlier when you were at Wharton, that you were a very productive scholar. That you wrote, that you did research, and you wrote.
You have to write if you're a professor. I knew that. I wrote from the time I was at Wharton. I think I have...
But that's somewhat the exception rather than the rule. If you look at the records of the faculty in the College of Business and in many other colleges, the professional colleges on the campus...
Well, I was
but you had an enviable record.
Well, the number's nice. I'm not sure how significant they were, but they were published and in good journals.
In jury journals. Good journals.
Good journals, yeah. There were a couple of toothbrush weeklies, but not too many.
So in many ways you could be considered a scholarly accountant.
Yeah,
is that a way to describe it?
Well, I would hope I could, yes. Yeah, I spent a great deal of time writing.
And you liked it?
I struggled with it. I didn't have a computer in those days, and I wrote in pencil and use scissors and paste. And
I'd still do it that way.
Well, I still do, too. I have 2 articles now on out for possible publication.
So you have not given up your that part of your career?
Well, I have, yes. I haven't done any real research. This was a hangover of research that I did when I was in the school.
But your big book is going to come out. It's going to metamorphosize all of these kinds of things. I mean, 1997, there's going to be this big splash. Willard Stone's memoirs and his look to the future.
That'll be the day.
You've never thought about doing your memoirs, have you?
No, I have not. And will not.
So do you think this is going to have to constitute it?
Yep. I'm counting on this.
You're counting on our cooperative effort.
I have a friend working on it now, is working on something. I think it's very minor. But he sent for this and is working up some kind of a thing on the Academy of Accounting Historians. They're going to publish something or other. I don't know what.
In Florida, or is this a
national? No, that's national. That's international. Mm-hmm.
When you were active in the department before your retirement, were you called upon to talk and to go to?
I'm never a great speech maker. I talked. I did a lot of talking, yes. I gave talks. And particularly when I visited as visiting professor in Australia and South Africa and New Zealand, Australia and South Africa, and the University of Kentucky and so on, you know. I was called upon to give talks, and I did, and I...
And you enjoyed it?
I enjoyed it somewhat. It's not my favorite occupation, but...
Have you and Louise done a lot of traveling?
We've been about around the world. There are some nations we haven't gotten into, but we've been around the world twice. We've been to New Zealand three times and spent some time teaching in South Africa and in Australia.
So it would be an obvious answer if I asked you if you enjoyed traveling.
Well, my wife enjoys it more than I do. She's now on my back to go to her elder hostel. So I guess we'll go.
So you'll go to an elder hostel.
Yes.
And in some far away exotic clime.
Well, we hope it'll be in Canada.
Well, that should be very delightful. Very
Northern
nice.
Territories, maybe.
When did you go around the world?
1966 was the first trip around the world. Made it all the way around.
By ship and air and all of those wonderful things?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I did that I like to mention, and I thought I did very well with it for the department, which was not particularly carried on, and that was the relationship with foreign universities. We had a postdoctoral program here, and we had 10 professors with doctor's degrees from Japan. We had a French postdoc. I think that was about it. But I tried very hard to develop that program. And we have very good relations. Personally, I have very good relations still with Japan. You'll notice I was editor of a series, which was a very pleasant occupation. It was hard work, but it got us a trip to Japan with all of the
accoutrements, yeah. All of the extras included.
Yep, had a good time. So it was my work with the foreign countries and with foreign students. Was very favorable.
And yet that is an effort. The university is interested in developing those kinds of relationships.
Well, the accounting department is not. When I tried to go to exchange with a professor from England, I was told that the department was too busy to take an exchange professor. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't go. They had no interest, apparently, in the Japanese program.
They had or have?
Had none. No interest. and have not since then.
This is true of the school, then?
Yeah, I don't think they're...
Because many areas of the university are developing these programs.
I looked at that as the development of the university with respect to their competitors at Stanford, Berkeley, and so on.
Because we have very active programs with Utrecht, for instance, and Cambridge University. Yeah. And
I even tried to get a reaction, a joint magazine with the University of Sydney in Australia, with Ray Chambers. And I brought in those people for conferences. But that was, I guess, one of my goals was to build a Stanford-type operation, a Berkeley-type operation, build the university into that. And the University of North Carolina has somewhat of that, you see. As I say, Dean Lee up there apparently noticed that because he tried to get me to come up there. But, I was a little late in my career.
I want to ask you a personal question. How did you get so involved
in... Is that still running?
Still, of course it's still running. I'm not going to leave anything out. How did you get all this involved in all of this hiking and walking and...
Oh.
Which is the envy of everybody who sees you, this young, energetic man.
Do you want a confession?
Yes.
I'm not simply walking. I'm treasure hunting.
Oh, I see.
When I retired... I became a collector, and I collect things by walking. I walk about 5-6 miles a day.
And you're the envy. I am envious of you.
Well, it's kept me in pretty good shape.
Oh, yes, you look marvelous, wonderful.
Oh, well, 82,
well,
I guess.
Yeah.
I could look worse.
Well, that's true of all of us.
Like Dean Hart's wife. Was one who always put her foot in her mouth. She was a delightful person. But my wife said to her one day that she was taking exercises and she so wished that it would help her hair. And Margaret Hart thought for a minute and she said, "Well, Louise, just think what it would look like if you didn't take exercises."
What kind of treasure are you looking for as you're going around collecting?
Well, I find pennies, mostly, but money.
But no Spanish doubloons.
And I hate to confess this, but I collect aluminum cans.
You don't have to confess to it. If it pays off, that's good. That'll pay off for your next Elder Hostel trip.
No, I get about $200 a year. But I do. I feel that it's a good thing to do.
And you're cleaning up, too.
I clean up some. By the way, I have a certificate from the mayor. Bill Howard was mayor. Wrote a certificate to me thanking me for cleaning the streets. And that was before these things, the signs went up, you know.
Willard, who else would you suggest that I do interviews with? People who may still be available and whose memories are like yours, you know, can remember and talk.
Fairly good.
I'm going to do Donovan, of course.
Donovan would be good.
And maybe even Al Ring.
Well, Al will have positive thoughts.
Oh, Al, I know what I'm
talking about. And lots of them. Al's a very positive individual.
He's even more energetic.
And I like Al.
Even more energetic than you are.
Oh.
He still plays tennis.
I take a back seat. Yep. And his mind is terrific.
Very sharp.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy. So, Al Ring, I think you should have him.
Anybody else that you can think of that would... You know, there's a limit to how many we can do, but I want to do some significant interviews.
Have you done Bob Bryan?
Well, he's on the list to do, yeah.
I think he's one of the most influential men in the university.
Yeah, we're going to do Bob Bryan, and then Bob's going to do some interviewing for us. He wants to become an oral historian, and he will be excellent.
He will be. He's good at anything he takes up.
What have we not talked about Willard, about Willard Stone's public career that we should mention? I'm glad you brought in about the exchange program, because that needs to be documented here too.
I would like to see that given mention, because I think it's dropped by the wayside, and I'm sorry for that. I think we had a good start. We had foreign students coming for graduate work from Australia, France.
Willard, are you a forgotten man in the college?
South Africa. Everybody's forgotten when you retire, Sam, Sam Proctor.
I know exactly what you're saying, but I'm just wondering if there is an effort within your college to maintain a relationship, not only with Willard Stone, but with others.
We're invited to the breakfast when alumni come in. Accounting has bad history they had some old-timers who never would give up, sort of Dean Wiles, and in different universities, not here. I deliberately, when I retired, I absolutely withdrew.
You cut the strings.
I made one offer, and it was refused. I offered to take over the graduate program for a while till John got started, you know. He wanted that right off for himself. So I, frankly, was cut off at retirement. Mm-hmm. And it's been pretty much that way since. Now, the outsiders are still friendly and still, I get invited to their son's weddings and so on. Mm-hmm. I have no real connection anymore with the university.
And that's true, really, in any academic community. Yeah. It's not just true at the University of Florida.
It's also healthy.
Yeah, yeah.
The ones that hang on and won't let go are a great problem to any university. And I've never been a problem to the university in that respect.
As you look back on your life, Willard, has it been a good life in terms of fulfilling your goals?
I have had a very fortunate life. I don't understand how I was so lucky. I got an excellent wife.
And a good family.
For me to get in from where I started from, to get into Wharton School, and get to be the department head here, fantastic.
Well, as you look back on your 80-plus years now, not only do you feel that you were fortunate, but do you feel that you achieved your goals? Did the things that you thought about as a young man?
Well, I think I probably should have done better. Particularly in writing, I started 2 books besides the one that I did take part in. And did not finish either one. Probably just as well. But I think I regret that. That always was a failing that I had. I didn't finish the books. But other than that,
you've had a satisfactory, happy life.
I think I had a quite contented and satisfied life.
As you look into the future, does it look dark and gloomy and all of those things?
No, not until the hyperinflation hits us, which will come. But I think that I probably won't be here.
You and I will have departed.
The national debt will be taken care of very quickly.
Yeah.
I am hoping that my little nest egg will hold out until we leave.
That's good.
And the health is holding out on both my wife's and mine, reasonably so. So I'm reasonably content.
Well, that's good. That's good.
I don't want to be a Sam Proctor.
No, you won't be. You won't
you
be.
You won't give up, Sam.
Well, I want you to know I appreciate this, giving up your time for this kind of thing. It was a most enjoyable experience.